I could give into the archives and give me a good income tax deduction or something of the sort. But we're not talking about our friend in the White House, but our friends in Indians, the red men. And before I read some quotations about what they've said about each other, I want to state my principal thesis. And that is how friends found Indians, or thought them to, what they thought they were like. They found them to be hospitable and helpful and trustworthy and truthful. They didn't swear either blasphemy or oaths. You take their, believe their word. They were democratic, non-authoritarian, didn't have any bosses or people to command. And in their business meetings, it was very democratic. Everybody had a chance to speak. They were patient to take as long as it might need to take, so that everybody had a chance to speak and everybody would understand the situation and come to a consensus, which was then articulated by the clerk. Call him the chief, call him the king, what you want to call him. We usually misnamed him because the leader was the servant of the people, very much more like the clerk of a Quaker meeting. He stated what he thought the minute would be and if the people would then approve or disapprove. Friends found that quite a congenial thing. Whether friends learned anything from Indians in this respect in their early visits, or whether it just happened to be that that's the way the Indians did it and also the way the friends did it without having had any mutual interaction. I'm pretty sure the friends did not teach the Indians how to do it. The Indians had been doing it that way all over the country for a long time. So if there was any influence one way or the other, it was Indians influencing Quakers. And I wonder if also Indians might have influenced Quakers with regard to the respect for women and children. Because I think we will agree that Quakers at that time respected women and children more than their contemporaries did. And whether they learned any of that from Indians or not, I wouldn't know. But it's something to think about, perhaps. Indians, in their worship, communicated personally and directly with deity. They didn't need the intercession of some priesthood. They could go seek a vision or meditate, and Indians were very, very easy with silence. They didn't have to keep talking with Indians all the time. They could sit comfortably together in silence, and friends found that very congenial. Some modern Indians have said, Christians go into churches to talk about Jesus. Indians go into the teepee to talk with Jesus. That's the modern day Native American church. Indians did not have paid priests. It was a participating religion, not a spectator religion. They didn't have people performing for them. Everybody present was a participant. And I think friends found that to be a congenial feature of Indians. And Indians, not being a literary sort of people with a written language, they valued and developed the art of oratory. They were good spokesmen. One thing that Quakers found about Indians that they didn't understand and never did come to full appreciation of, and that is the idea of property. Not only land property, but personal property. Well, perhaps I shouldn't say personal property, like your clothing, but tools and equipment and things in general, Indians attach no value to them, except as they might be useful. And they would be useful to whoever could use them. And if the person who had them couldn't use them, well, then it was quite all right for a person who could use them to take them. And as I say, land. Quakers thought that you could buy land. Indians never understood that concept at all, and so there was considerable misunderstanding between all of the Europeans and Indians in that regard. Well, now for some of the statements about what Quakers have said about Indians and later what Indians have said about Quakers, I'll read some quotations. In 1658, the first Quaker to come to this country that I know about, Josiah Cole and Thomas Thurston They said, "We found these Indians more sober and Christian-like toward us than the Christians so-called." And in 1667, John Bowater stated that he was more kindly used by the poor Indians in America than by some pretended Christians here in England. And in 1671, George Fox came to this country, this area, traveled from Virginia to Long Island, or about that. He found that they didn't profit very much from preaching. They would not accept good precepts from those who in practice despoiled them. Said, "Let your light shine among the Indians, the blacks and the whites, that ye may answer the truth in them." I think one of the reasons that Friends Quakers came to this area, not only was to spread the gospel, but not only that, but they all had the theory of the inner light and that of God in every man. And if that were to be true, then it would have to be testable scientifically, experimentally at least, by finding out if that was true for Indians, who did not have a reputation for being equal to the English. So if they could find that out, they would prove the point. And so they would always ask Indians, "Do you feel in somewhere that something that tells you if you've done wrong?" And they were always assured, and by example they, Friends, ascertained that that seemed to be quite true for Indians, that there was that of God in Indians also. Elizabeth Newport said that Indians were divided into pagans and Christians. The pagans believed in Quaker worship and the guidance of the Spirit, while the Christians seek information from the missionaries. Then, of course, William Penn wrote here before he came, and, oh, thanks, Yuppie. And one of his first letters: "There is a great God and power that hath made the world and all things therein, to whom you and I and all people owe their being and well-being, and to whom you and I must one day give an account for all that we do in the world. This great God hath written his law in our hearts, by which we are taught and commanded to love, to help, and do good to one another. Now this great God hath been pleased to make me concerned in your part of the world, and the king of the country where I live hath given me a great province therein, but I desire to enjoy it with your love and consent, that we may always live together as neighbors and friends." And of course made the famous treaty at Chickamauga in 1681. Voltaire said it was never sworn to and never broken. The only treaty never sworn to and never broken. It's historically, I don't know that they know exactly what was agreed to in that treaty, but there are many such treatyings, and so it's an academic point, I suppose, as to what the date was of any particular treaty. But in his dealings with the Indians, he had the European concept of being able to buy the land, but tempered somewhat with the Indian concept that the seller did not have to move away. Penn, William Penn, Sr., never asked the Indians to move away. It was simply to permit the English to move in there and to be friends together, which was the case as long as William Penn was in control. 750,000 acres was purchased by Penn for $1.25, a gun, some powder, some lead, a pair of stockings, a coat, and some woolen cloth. That's obviously a gift. That's just being, it's a reciprocal arrangement of friendship, and not what we would call a remuneration for disposing of the land and moving away, changing a way of life. William Penn Jr. bought all the land between the Delaware and the Susquehanna River for 2 guns, 2 pieces of wool cloth, and 4 kettles. Obviously, it's just a hostess present, I mean, a hospitality present. It's not a purchase at all. Penn said, "I have been unkindly used by some I left behind me, but I have found love and respect where I came. Nor were the natives wanting in this, for their kings, queens, and great men both visited and presented me, to whom I made suitable returns. It was just an exchange of presents between friends. And as I say, William Penn didn't require the Indians to move off, but in practice they had to. With so many colonists coming in with fences, cattle, and the colonists also liking to shoot deer for venison, it was, became necessary for the Indians to move elsewhere to live by hunting. John Richardson in 1701 said, "The Indians did not speak two at a time, nor interfere in the least with one another. My spirit was very easy with them. I did not feel that power of darkness to oppress me as I had done in many places among the people called Christians. Their councils were like Quaker business meetings." John Woolman, 1762, said, "The friends believed even from the first more in instruction and useful arts and the daily practice of Christian virtues while living and working with the Indians." And then the famous statement in his journal, "Love was the first motion, and thence arose a concern to spend some time with the Indians, that I might feel and understand their life and the spirit they live in, if haply I might receive some instruction from them, or they might be in any degree helped forward by my following the leading of the truth among them. That idea, if haply I might receive some instruction from them, made the relationship of Quakers and Indians really a unique one. Many good people went to visit Indians to benefit the Indians, ostensibly or hopefully, to teach the Indians, but I know of nobody that ever went to the Indians hoping to learn from the Indians, except the friends." Anthony Benezet in 1784 said, "Is it not notorious that they are generally kinder to us than we are to them? There is scarce an instance occurs, but that they treat every white man who comes amongst them with respect, which is not the case from us to them." Now one from corn planter and Indian to friends. This photo of a letter, obviously written by some friend, but signed by corn planter, his mark. In other words, he just puts a little mark at the bottom, and it's all in this fancy prose of that era, when he asks friends if they will educate his son and a couple other Seneca boys in Philadelphia, 1791, which they do. And in 1793, the Iroquois sent a letter to George Washington. "Now we desire you, brothers, to send forward agents." I don't know why he addresses Washington as brothers, but that's... "Now we desire you, brothers, to send forward agents who are men of honesty, not proud lion jobbers, but men who love and desire peace. Also, we desire that they may be accompanied by a friend or Quaker, to attend the council." And, of course, at that time, friends frequently did attend the councils at which treaties were drawn up, on which one such occasion, Red Jacket said, "Brothers, we know that your fathers and ours transacted business together, and that you look upon the Great Spirit for his direction and guidance, and that you take no part in war. We are now in the presence of the Great Spirit, and we place more confidence in you than in any other people. As you expressed your desire for peace, we now desire your help and assistance. We hope you will not to deceive us. If you should do so, we shall place no more any confidence in mankind." So friends did go to treatying at Buffalo Creek and Canandaigua in 1795, when the famous treaty was drafted and agreed to, which was then violated recently when the Kinzua Dam was built. In 1795 also, the Indian committees of New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore meetings were established, which were the first committees of any kind that these yearly meetings set up for any kind of social outreach, which committees are still in and still function. In 1798, Joel Swain, Holliday Jackson, and Henry Simmons went to the Seneca Indians in along the Allegheny River, northern Pennsylvania, southern New York. The first two teaching trades and agriculture, and Henry Simmons teaching more academic subjects. And he taught in corn planters' home. When corn planter's half-brother, Handsome Lake, was a drunkard and sick and usually in a torpor or stupor, but apparently he was picking it all up, what Henry Simmons was saying, what he was teaching the children. And on the 6th month, 15th, 1799, Handsome Lake went into a trance, and in Henry Simmons's diary of that day, being present, he writes it all up of what happened. The corn planter being from home about 3/4 of a mile, where he had men employed to build him a house, and where we were engaged in erecting a school, an express, that is a messenger, came to him that his brother or stepbrother was dying, who had been on the decline of life for several years. Well, I have that diary here if anybody wants to read it. I think it's extremely interesting. Because it's on that very occasion that Handsome Lake expounded what he said he had learned by going to heaven when he was in a trance, and what he told was his vision, which is now recited every year at the ceremonies in the longhouse of the Seneca Indians in New York State, very much influenced by Quakerism, partly Aboriginal Indian, but partly partly Quakerism. And I could quote you some of it. And I'll read some of it. All men are made equal by the Great Spirit, but he has given to them a variety of gifts. To some a pretty face, to others an ugly one. To some a comely form, to others a disfigured figure. Some are fortunate in collecting around them worldly goods, but you are all entitled to the same privileges and therefore must put pride from among you. You are not your own makers, nor the builders of your own fortunes. All things are the gifts of the Great Spirit, and to him must be returned thanks for their bestowal. He alone must be acknowledged as the giver, etc. I could read more of that, but I hope you may be interested enough to read some more of it yourself. And many of us from the Philadelphia area go when we can to attend the midwinter ceremonies in the longhouse and find a warm welcome there. Sometimes there were some little misunderstandings, and some friends who were doing teaching and agriculture and milling and blacksmithing and that sort of thing had brought tools which they would lend to the Indians, and then sometimes the Indians wouldn't return them, and friends would ask to have them back and then would rent them or sell them, and there got to be some disagreements there as to Indian difference of opinion as to what property is worth, what things are worth. And in 1806, the Indians write to the friends, "Brothers, the Indians have understood that there was a large sum of money raised by the Quakers to assist them, and they want to know how this money was laid out and whether these mills was paid for out of that money. For you have built them mills, and the Indians buy boards from you, and sometimes they can't tell whether you are helping them or they are helping you." Well, it got to be something of a dispute, and the friends thought that the best thing to do was to simply leave and give all the stuff to the Indians, and because the Indians were beginning to accuse them that the friends were going to charge them for this someday and have to pay for it. And, well, but finally, 1850, Cattaraugus Seneca write this letter to the Hicksite Friends Committees. "Brothers, it is with much pain and sorrow we learn that you are to close your labors among us. When we turn our faces backward and look over the histories of the past, we find that more than 50 winters have gone by since the Iroquois, or the Six Nations of the Indians, first selected the Hodiwiyisto as their friends upon whom they could repose confidence without fear of being betrayed. The Hodiwiyisto means those who bring the good message quietly." I guess there was a lot of hymn singing by the others. "Brothers, we have as associates passed through many dangers and severe trials and hardships. In all these, you have ever stood by us and been our support, have counseled us in our troubles, consoled us in our misfortunes, and strengthened us when feeble, and often relieved our necessities. All of these kind offices have endeared you to us. To part are words too severe for our ears." some of these flowery languages, you sort of wonder who wrote them, and somewhat with the oratory too, because obviously when the oratory was in the Seneca or other language, and what has been recorded is put down by somebody who could understand it but spoke and wrote English. And some of these letters undoubtedly have been composed by others. Thomas Batty, a quote that he quotes a Comanche chief saying, "My friend, I can see your heart. It good, full of love. He love Indian. I can never hurt man when I see heart like this, full of love. I love him." The Batty's book is back here, and it's been out. It's an old book, but it's been reissued, and I urge you to read the new reissued, because the original one, there is a chapter is included in the new issue, which was deleted from the first. It was felt not to be too suitable, apparently, by the editors a couple generations ago. Friends from this area established a school at Tunisasa in 1804, in Cattaraugus, the Thomas School, which I'll show you a picture of what now is there. In 1833, he was a relative of M. Carey Thomas, of Bryn Mawr and a Baltimore friend. And after that, as Indians moved west, friends set up schools in many places, Ohio and Indiana, Illinois, Kansas, Oklahoma, and also down in North Carolina, Virginia. In 1869, Grant's peace policy, the Army had made such a mess of Indian affairs that President Grant was persuaded to let the churches, and in particular, friends, manage the administration of the superintendencies in Oklahoma, Indian Territory, Nebraska, Kansas. And that Associated Executive Committee of Friends on Indian Affairs, which was then set up, is still in existence and just had its annual meeting last weekend, 8-10 days ago, in Philadelphia. In 1929, when Hoover was president, he appointed Charles Rhodes and Henry Scattergood, Philadelphia friends, to be Commissioner of Indian Affairs and Associate or Assistant Commissioner of Indian Affairs. They initiated reforms that were very beneficial, particularly in education, and got the Merriam Report, the first thoroughgoing analysis of the problems of Indian affairs, but were not maybe as effective as might have been in persuading Congress to implement the new policies, but it was certainly a innovation and a great improvement in Indian affairs. What do they call them? Lawrence, were they the Quaker twins that they were called?
They were called that.
They were very good close friends, of course, and although one was the commissioner and one was the assistant commissioner, they cooperated so closely that they were just looked as the two of them being commissioner. Historically, maybe bring up the chronology, in maybe the 1950s, the American Friends Service Committee took an active interest in friends and in Indians nationwide, particularly through from the Philadelphia office, and then more recently, more through the regional offices. Cambridge relates to the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot in Maine primarily. Philadelphia and Baltimore relate to the Lumbee and Tuscarora Indians in eastern North Carolina, and somewhat with the Seminoles in Florida. Des Moines with the Plains, and at present they're sort of watching the trials out at Rapid City and Sioux Falls, and also programs in Oklahoma, largely with schools, the rights of children. Pasadena with the Southern California and Arizona and New Mexico problems. Also at present, they're taking an interest in the strip mining of the around the Four Corners, and Navajo and Hopi land, and Des Moines, I guess it is taking an interest in the strip mining on the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow reservations in Montana. No, I guess that would be Seattle. And Seattle has a considerable interest in Indians in the Northwest, many tribes in the state of Washington, these fishing rights. In 1961, Philadelphia Indians became quite interested in, Philadelphia Quakers became quite interested in the problems of the Seneca Indians in New York State because of the building of the Kinswood Dam and the flooding of a good deal of that reservation, which you'll see some pictures. We had Walter Taylor working there as a community development person. Another thing that Indians have said about Quakers occurred a few months ago in Philadelphia when Vine Deloria was speaking, and somebody asked him about, he asked him particularly about friends, and he said that the work that the friends did in fighting the Kinswood Dam was not in vain and was very much appreciated. Now, Vine can be pretty sharp about church people, do-gooders, and but he does have a lot of respect for friends. He's written this Custer Died for Your Sins, in which he takes some jabs at people like us. But he also says later on in the book that we're their only hope, too. So maybe we're not doing as well as we ought to do. There's no doubt about that. But it can be appreciated also. So I think those are the remarks. I hope you'll have some questions, and I hope there'll be time for it. But I guess I want to show slides now. Are there any questions that you think of? Those of you who are sitting on the side, I wish you'd sit right down here on the front benches. You'll see so much better. Yes. And over there on the side are much better than too remote. Turn it on. Put it on bright all the way up. Yes, that's the one who needs to start out. Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, if you did have any questions or do later on as to where Y is on the map, that's it. George Fox, who, as I said, visited Indians in this country and found them very congenial. And I really think the Indians contributed something to his and to our outlook on religion and life. William Penn is portrayed in Harrisburg in the State Museum. Now you may see that his left hand is touching something to his bosom. And in relief, you may see the figure of an Indian. And various people wonder what that means. The guide there tells you that the artist says that means religious freedom. But I don't think it's anything quite so abstruse. It's simply that he was a friend of the Indians. In the Historical Society, Pennsylvania Historical Society in Philadelphia, the wampum that the Indians gave William Penn at the Treaty of Chickamauga, presumably. And the two figures are also a matter of some dispute. I think the correct interpretation is, and Frank Speck always says so in one of his writings, and I've asked some Indians, and they all agree, that the big fellow is the Indian. And that hat that he has on is not some Quaker hat, but maybe some kind of a headdress, perhaps. But the Indian is the dominant figure who owns all the land, and the skinny fella is the supplicant who symbolically is less powerful, and he is asking for the right to move in. The Currier and Ives print from the famous Benjamin West painting, the original of which is in Philadelphia, Benjamin West. And this is one of the Hicks versions of the same thing. This is in the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa. And the portrait of Penn and, I don't know if T.S. Conway, I don't think it is. Oh, it's a Tanaman. The painting which was in 15th and Ray Street, but was given by Philadelphia Friends to the state. It's now in Harrisburg in the State Museum. This is a famous story of Quakers meeting and the Indians coming in and seeing no guns and seeing everybody peaceful and quiet caused them no trouble. Now this is not Quaker, but I put it in because so many people bring it up as though it were a Quaker thing, and that is the walking purchase of 1737, when William Penn's sons said that their father had an agreement with the Indians to take 3 days' worth of land, that is, the amount of land that you could walk around in 3 days, and that he had only taken a day and a half's worth, and they wanted the rest of it. Well, nobody ever produced the document that says proved this debt, but the Indians said, all right. So they started out down here at Wrightstown. They blazed the trail and trained some athletes, three of them, to run as fast as they could. It wasn't a walk. Nobody could keep up with them. One of them collapsed the first day and died a few months later. Another one collapsed the next day, and he lived out about a year, never regaining his health. One of them, John Marshall, made it up to Bois Chunk, or Jim Thorpe, call it now. And then, how much land does that surround? Well, they just then drew on the map that line up to the river, not to bring it over here the shortest distance, or to bring it here or something like that, but to surround as much. They just took all the rest of it. It was simply outraging the Indians, and T.D. Uskung was so outraged that he made a lot of trouble, and finally some Philadelphia merchants made a purse to sort of buy him off and to assuage him. And there the Indians had to move out. The Bethlehem Allentown area was an area of great population in the forks of the Lehigh and the Delaware River, places where there are many Indians. This was really an outrage, and that was the end of the peaceful relationship between the colony and the Indians. John Woolman, I quoted his famous statement. He traveled alone, maybe with a companion, I'm not sure, in wartime, during the Indian Wars, to visit Indians. Everybody thought he'd be killed. At one of the treaties, Buffalo Creek, the Indians over here, and here are the Quakers. Back here, observers along with the diplomats and the Romney people. Oh, not too important where the different reservations are in Western New York State, Buffalo Creek, Tonawanda. The people that filled up your friends have been mostly led to are this reservation here. Here's the Pennsylvania border. Kinsler Dam is down about here now. It wasn't. Now, Handsome Lake, I told you, influenced by the Friends teacher. And this is that page in the book that I read. 6 month 15th, the corn planter being from home, etc. And his brother laying breathless for the space of half an hour, but in about 2 hours after he came to, etc. Quaker Bridge. That's the Allegheny State Park on the other side of the Allegheny River. And this is the area where the Philadelphia Friends were conducting school and teaching the Indians. Still called Quaker Bridge, although the bridge doesn't exist. That's all it's all been stripped off, and that's all flooded land now. But that area is the Quaker Bridge area. This is the longhouse that used to be at Cold Spring, very near where Burnt House or where Corn Planter lived. Incidentally, Corn Planter was named Corn Planter because he was influenced by Quakers to become a corn planter and not be a hunter, because he said you will be better fed, there'll be less famine, if you depend less on hunting and more on agriculture. And this is close to where he lived, and that's the longhouse. Very similar to an old-time country meeting house with a one door for the men, one door for the women, about the same proportions, about the same kind of heating arrangement. I have that statement here. It's much too long to read at the moment, but I hope maybe some of you might be curious and want to read it, but it is a modern day statement by a Mohawk Indian who publishes has a little museum up at John Shield in New York, which I recommend to if you ever get up that way. His friendly statement of appreciation of the things that friends have done over the years and their attitudes. Now, there was a time when Indians were the particular social interest of Quakers. That was the one interest the Quakers had of the social nature concern. And so this map shows where the yearly meetings of friends are and where the Indian tribes are. So the areas of the different Maryland quarterly, Maryland yearly meeting, et cetera. The areas of the New England yearly meeting, and also where the Indian tribes were. As I said, the Indians, Quakers followed the Indians as they migrated and built schools. This is one in North Carolina, built about 100 years ago, up the Big Cove, and that building has been used by the American Friends Service Committee and by Haverford College as a headquarters for work camps on more than half a dozen occasions. It doesn't exist now, but these are some of the friends who are superintendents in Oklahoma. And there are places in Oklahoma which have Indian names, I mean Quaker names, Darlington and you see a road sign telling about Josiah Butler and Laurie Tatum. Kicking Bird, Coyote Chief. A descendant of his, Kicking Bird, was in Philadelphia at the conference the Fellowship of Reconciliation put on in January. Kirk Kicking Bird, who is a lawyer and an author, orator, young man. Batty's book tells a good bit about Kicking Bird. So he was one of the people that the friends were dealing with when they were superintendents in Oklahoma. And at the Carlisle School, which was an Indian school, Quaker ladies at Carlisle School in June 1880, along with Spotted Tail. He was the chief of the Rosebud Sioux. He sent a couple of his sons to Carlisle to be educated. I forget the exact story, but I think at least one of them died there, and he was very much disillusioned. I'm sure he regretted that he'd ever sent any children to Carlisle. It was not a Quaker institution, but undoubtedly some of the personnel must have been Quakers, and they certainly cooperated in trying to civilize the Indians. This one. Is that this too? No. This is one of the four Quaker churches in Oklahoma. This is a McLeod for the Kickapoo Indians. The church and the building back here was built as a community building, and that was the only building that was available to the tribe for its tribal meetings and for its council and committee work and that sort of thing. But then subsequently, the friends gave 15 acres of their land to the tribe. Now the tribe had no land at all. But now with this 15 acres, of course the Quakers had been given their whole allotment at a previous time from Indian land. So the friends gave some of it back. Now that the tribe owned some land, they became eligible for federal aid and a large community building, should have put the picture in here, was built with federal money, and they have a very fine head start and a playground and a cemetery, a community building of their own. At Seneca Council House, summer Bible school, for the community. Some of the people look Indian and some of them don't. And most of them, I would say, are somewhat Indian. Larry Pickard conducting the class. And the Wyandotte Church building, there's a federal boarding school for Indians nearby, and the friends at this church have been very instrumental or very useful in conducting religious exercises and education for the Indian school. And the church at Hominy for the Osage. David Owl was a pastor at that previous church. After he retired as a Presbyterian minister, he's a Cherokee, now living on the Cattaraugus Seneca Reservation. And Pauline Seneca in the middle, who was educated here in Westchester, the what was then called the State Normal School. She's a Cayuga Indian, in spite of her name Seneca, having married a Seneca by the name of Seneca.